Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
From KQED.
My family and I just got back from a trip in Central and South America, and one of my favorite places that we visited is called the Guna Yala province in Panama. It's a place where the Kuna tribe controls the economy, and they've prohibited development on these pristine islands in the middle of turquoise blue water in the Caribbean. It really struck me as an example of what can happen when indigenous communities are allowed to have control over their ancestral lands and when they're allowed to govern according to their values. It made me think a lot about how different things are here in California, where some tribes are still struggling just to be recognized. We do have 109 federally recognized Native American tribes here in our state, but they've largely been erased from the narrative of California's history. There is a long history of activism in Native American communities here, though, and those decades of work are starting to pay off. One of the most obvious examples is around efforts to reclaim ancestral land. I'm Sasha Coca, and today on the California Report magazine, we've got a show all about the way California indigenous communities are exercising power in ways big and small. We're going to hear about an effort to reclaim ancestral Coast Miwok land in Marin County, and we're going to head to Round Valley to meet folks who are fighting just to get a safe path to walk through their town. But let's start by meeting a chef in Oakland who's opened a new restaurant to celebrate Native American cuisine. KQED's Bianca Taylor is going to bring us her story as part of a series we're calling Flavor Profile, featuring folks who started successful food businesses during the pandemic.
It's a busy Friday morning at Wapepa's Kitchen. A team of people is chopping green jalapenos into coins, rinsing pinto beans in a large pot, and removing seeds from dried red chilies to blend with maple syrup and olive oil.
This goes for the rye bread tacos. It goes ground rice, beans. She just made the salsa, and it comes cheese, lettuce. And so this is what we added on the menu last week.
That's Chef Crystal Wapepa. She's wearing a black T-shirt and red beaded earrings in the shape of small strawberries. She's moving around the industrial kitchen like a conductor, directing, observing, praising. It makes sense that she feels so at home here.
I always wanted to be an indigenous chef, pretty much like at a very young age, because I really, really loved cooking and I have that connection when it comes to the soil, to the land.
Like her mother and grandfather, Crystal is a member of the Kickapoo tribe of Oklahoma. Her first memories of cooking indigenous foods are making fry bread with her auntie and grandmother when she was just 7 years old. But growing up in Oakland on Ohlone land, surrounded by diverse neighbors and food from all over the world, Crystal was struck by how there were no native restaurants. This was decades before Berkeley's Cafe Ohlone. She wanted to change that. She graduated from the prestigious Cordon Bleu Culinary School and in 2010 opened one of the first Native American woman-owned catering businesses in California.
I've done the White House, I've done James Beard Awards.
But she wasn't just cooking, she found herself doing a lot of educating too.
I'm in San Francisco, in the tech world, literally going out of my native community, serving these foods no one's never heard of, so I had all the questions brought at me. You know, up to, oh yeah, this is Native American land, huh?
At the beginning of 2020, she had just started selling her indigenous snack bars online. Treats made with wild rice, amaranth, pepita, and cranberries when COVID hit. Then she found out the kitchen where she ran her catering business was closing.
I was like, okay, what am I gonna do? People were supporting me all throughout the whole nation with this wild rice bar. And I was like, okay, I need to find another space.
So she reached out to her community to see if anyone had a kitchen space she could share. But a few months later, a friend came back with a different, bigger proposal, an entire restaurant in Oakland's Fruitvale Station. This was not really what Crystal had envisioned. She had a successful catering business. A restaurant was a whole different world.
When you have a restaurant, this is who you are. This is your personality. This is your heart and your soul, your hard labor.
Remember, this was at a time when the Bay Area had some of the strictest COVID restrictions around indoor dining. And even if people could go out to eat, a lot of us were too scared to do so. Opening a restaurant during a pandemic was a huge financial risk.
That was nuts. But at the same time, I still wanted to have that space and create.
Crystal meditated on the offer for about a year. She weighed the financial uncertainty against what had always driven her.
We have a huge Native community here in the Bay Area. I feel like this is a space that needs to be represented, need to be seen within our community. I said, okay, let's do it.
So she opened Wapepa's Kitchen in November 2021. The community response assured Crystal she had done the right thing.
I was just only expecting about like maybe 50, 75 people to show up on our opening. We had almost 1,200. There was dancing, drums, music, celebration. I can still tear up to this day. I was so like, wow, our time has come. Our mission is to say, one, we're here. At the same time, I want people to come here and have that home away from home to eat different kind of foods from different tribes.
The menus at Wapepa's Kitchen are written in the Kickapoo language with English translations. Starters include taquitos hand-rolled with smoked hibiscus and a mixture of sweet and white potatoes. You can order a side of deer sticks with a chokecherry dipping sauce. All the ingredients Crystal uses come directly from native food producers.
Our blue corn comes from the Northern Ute Nation. Our bison comes from the Cheyenne River. The beans come from the Pima Maricopa Nation. Our maple comes from the Ottawa. This is something that they have been reclaiming and reviving and protecting and saving, and we have the honor to serve it on our table.
Her favorite dish on the menu is the Three Sisters Veggie Bowl with rice, squash, and beans. The other ingredients rotate seasonally, so the bowl features produce from as many as 5 different tribes at once. This summer, the bowl includes strawberries, a special ingredient to Crystal.
I lived on the Hoopa Reservation at a young, very young age, and where I found my connection with the berries. When I got to go to Oklahoma with my grandfather, we would gather berries. It's my little place of home, of happiness. And if it makes me happy, I want to make somebody else happy.
Nearly 2 years after opening, Wapepa's Kitchen is a full-blown expression of Crystal's love for Native community. Central to her mission is acknowledging how colonization violently separated Native American tribes from their foodways.
Different Native American tribes being moved, all of us has the same story of how our foods were lost.
This started with the killing of the buffalo in the 1860s, what President Grant called America's solution to the country's quote-unquote Indian problem. One U.S. Army member is said to have told his troops, every buffalo dead is an Indian gone. The policy of violent separation continued in the 1950s, when the Indian Relocation Act forced Native people to leave their reservations and move to the cities. We still see the connected battle over Native food and land sovereignty today, like the fight over the Dakota Access Pipeline on the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, which the tribe says would poison their drinking water.
And a lot of people are lost from this land just because of historical trauma had taken place. And I think it's very, very important where everybody must come to a Native American restaurant and get educated.
And that's one of Crystal's main goals for Wapepa's Kitchen, reconnecting tribes back to the food of their homelands.
We come from a lot of historical trauma, and if we don't have these foods in the community, how are we going to heal from the past?
It starts in the kitchen with the staff, who represent 17 different tribes. This includes Crystal's 3 daughters, who are members of the Big Valley Rancheria Pomo tribe.
I just want people to come here and be in the space and relate to the foods, and this is where we connect.
On a sunny Wednesday afternoon, Odelia Young is taking her lunch break at Wapepa's Kitchen. She's been a fan of the restaurant since it opened.
I feel like it's always like a sharing of like culture with us. It isn't just a place to come and consume, but it's a place to like come and connect.
She's not Native American, but says coming here to eat is a unique opportunity to learn more about the people who were first on this land.
Yeah, I think it's just really special to have spaces where you can have these authentic connections with Indigenous culture and people.
Across the table, her coworker Vina Vo agrees.
A lot of these ingredients I don't really know of, and the flavors are very different than what I'm used to. And so I think when you're able to look at different ingredients, different flavors, you can kind of get a feel for what was available at that time or in that place, in that space, in that land.
But people don't just come to Wapipa's kitchen to eat. A wall in the restaurant displays the presents people have brought her. Mason jars packed with butternut squash seeds, seaweed, and blue cornflower, bundles of dried sage, and clay pots filled with succulents. These are gifts of gratitude from her native community to thank her for the home she's created, a home some of them never thought they'd see again.
A lot of elders come and they'll sit here and they say, I never thought I would sit in a Native American restaurant and I wanted to come here today. And it's wow.
In addition to running Wapipa's Kitchen, Crystal is working on a cookbook, which makes all of this a 7-day-a-week labor of love. Because when she's doing this work, she feels reconnected to her family.
My grandmother, she would love it. She might not be here physically, but she's here. When we go into the fall season time, you'll see a fry bread on the side or even cornbread. It's her. She's here.
For the California Report, I'm Bianca Taylor in Oakland.
And now we're heading to the farthest reaches of eastern Mendocino County, to Round Valley and the remote community of Covelo. The main drag in Covelo is Highway 162, which runs right through the middle of town. There's no public transportation here. Locals who don't have a car pretty much have to walk on the highway, which has almost no shoulder to get anywhere in this community. A lot of residents here are members of the Round Valley Indian tribes, like Latrice Hopper, who's Pomo. Last year, she was walking home from her job at a pizza place in town.
I just wanted to get home because I was tired from working all day.
She lived on the other side of town.
And I heard these cars behind me, and they sounded pretty close, and I looked back, and I could see, like, kind of headlights really close to me.
The first car grazed her leg.
And then the second car ended up hitting me in the shoulder and in the back of the head with their rear mirror.
It took Latrice months to recover. She had to quit her job. She became severely depressed. But she knows she was lucky.
The first thing I could think of was just how grateful I was that I was still alive.
This stretch of Highway 162 is notoriously dangerous for pedestrians. Residents here have been pushing authorities for more than a decade, asking them to build a pedestrian path that would be set back from the road. Reporter Eileen Russell lives near Covelo, and she's going to take us to Round Valley to help us understand why this transportation project is so critical and why it's been held up for so long.
Round Valley is home to 7 tribes living on Yuki ancestral lands. Shireen Rosales grew up here. She's a Round Valley tribal member, descendant of Yuki, Concow, and Pitt River people. She remembers her grandparents' house as the center of family life.
Every Sunday, they had Sunday dinner no matter what. Everybody was welcome, so everybody showed up.
Her grandparents helped out in other ways, too.
My grandparents stepped in and helped my mother because my mother was a single mother, and, you know, I lived with my grandparents.
This is a tight-knit community, so even though Shireen didn't live with her mother, she saw her mom a lot. She'd visit and stay for a night or two, walking across town on Highway 162, cars flying by.
We were taught how to walk on the road, me and my sisters.
A lot has changed in Round Valley over the years. The mill that employed many tribal members shut down and the timber business dried up. According to 2020 census numbers, a third of the population lives below the poverty line, and drug and alcohol addiction are common. Shireen moved to the larger town of Ukiah, looking for more options.
Me and my husband decided that we were going to raise our kids off the reservation and try something different and make it out from the hard life that I was raised in.
But Shireen's younger sister, Misty, wasn't so lucky. She stayed in Round Valley and struggled with drugs and alcohol. Misty knew her lifestyle wasn't healthy for her 8 kids, so she asked Shireen to take care of them.
She knew that her kids would be safe with me. She trusted me, and I trusted her.
One day in 2018, Shireen was in her front room when the phone rang.
I can remember it was still daylight when we got the call that she was hit.
Misty had been walking along Highway 162 when she was hit by a drunk driver.
I thought about her kids and what I was going to have to explain to them.
Misty was on life support for 3 days. Her friends and family gathered around her, and Shireen had to make a difficult decision.
The hardest things to ever see is losing a sibling like that and having that put on me and my grandmother and my older nieces, my sister's kids, of having to make that decision to pull that plug and watch my sister's life just be taken away from her. You know, I mean, she was my first best friend.
Shireen says her sister made mistakes, but she was also a good person. She'll always remember her as a strong Native woman.
And I believed if her life wasn't taken, that one day she would have been in her children's lives and been their mother. She left me a gift. My memory of her is left with her children, and I get to raise them. I get to take care of them. I get to love them the way that she would want to love them.
Shireen's angry that the drunk driver who hit Misty was never punished. Since Misty died in 2018, at least 3 more people have been hit and killed on Highway 162.
There's a lot of people that have been hit on that road and have died on that road. And that should have brought awareness even before my sister was hit and killed.
The Round Valley tribal government identified the need for a walking trail set back from the road 10 years before Misty's death. They've been trying to get Caltrans to build it ever since.
I mean, it was identified that there was this great need for a separated walking and biking path parallel to 162, really because of the fatalities that had happened along there.
Nefeli Barrett is the executive director of the Mendocino Council of Governments, a nonprofit working to coordinate local and regional transportation projects.
There are no shoulders along much of 162 where it runs through Round Valley.
It's the only way to get to the tribal offices, the health center, Covelo's downtown. But back in 2008, Caltrans was narrowly focused on the roads themselves.
They didn't have the capacity to take on a trail project.
Caltrans has since broadened their focus to include complete streets, stuff like walking, biking, and transit projects. So now, after more than a decade and a half of lobbying from Round Valley residents, construction crews are finally beginning work on a pedestrian trail set back from the road.
It's almost hard to believe it's finally happening.
Latrice Hopper, the woman who was hit by a car on her way home from work and survived, says the new trail is a big deal.
It does give me hope to where I hope I can be able to walk comfortably without having to worry about getting hit by a car.
A walking trail may seem like a small thing, but it's a huge victory in this rural community that often feels forgotten and ignored. The center of tribal life will now be connected to downtown Covelo. Kids will be able to safely ride their bikes to the main park in town. And hopefully, nobody else will lose their life walking on Highway 162. For the California Report, I'm Eileen Russell in Round Valley.
One of the most visible examples that we have of Native American activism in our state is the effort to reclaim ancestral land. There's the island that was returned to the Wiat tribe in Humboldt County, or the 1,200-acre ranch that the Esalen tribe bought near Big Sur. In fact, there are more than a dozen land-back projects that have successfully returned land to tribes here in California recently. The latest is in Marin County, which is just north of San Francisco. KQED's Vanessa Rancagno takes us there to meet the people behind the fight to reclaim land in what's one of California's most expensive counties.
When Joe Sanchez was 8 years old, his grandmother took him from his home in San Mateo to downtown San Francisco. It was 1956, and his grandmother was among 400 Native Americans from around California gathering at the Civic Auditorium to take a vote. The Bureau of Indian Affairs was offering a deal. A few $100 per person in exchange for giving up their land rights.
Numerous people got up on the stage and said, you know, this is not for us. We'll lose our sovereignty. We'll lose everything for the, you know, a few $100.
California's tribal lands were being liquidated, part of the government's policy of termination and relocation. Over 100 tribes across the country were cut off from federal assistance. Some were ordered to dissolve their governments and distribute their land. The U.S. wanted to assimilate members into mainstream society. Joe watched the participants record their votes in pencil on small pieces of paper. Afterward, a BIA official announced the deal had passed.
And right away, I felt the pressure, the air, just go out of the room.
He was just a kid who'd never heard the word sovereignty before that day, but he read a lot into the silence.
What I felt at the time was like this had happened before. It was just one loss after another, after another, after another, after another.
When they got outside, his grandmother knelt down in front of him.
She stopped, looked at me in the eyes and said, "Don't ever forget you're a California Indian. Don't ever forget." And I swore at that time that I would never forget.
Joe has spent a lot of his adult life trying to live up to that promise. He studied the history of his people, the Coast Miwok. And a few years ago, he helped start the Coast Miwok Tribal Council of Marin to preserve that history and culture and share it. Now, at 75, Joe is the force behind a new project he thinks his grandma would be especially grateful for.
But this view is something, isn't it? We can just imagine what it was like before the European invasion.
We're standing on a 26-acre piece of land in ancestral Coast Miwok territory in Marin County. It's nestled in rolling hills, covered in tall grasses, brush, and oaks. Joe and the tribal council bought the land earlier this year.
We needed a place to have ceremony, a place where we could do all those things that we always did for thousands of years.
They imagined a place where they could bring together people with Coast Miwok roots from around the region. They want to build a dance arbor, a roundhouse, a sweat lodge, places to dance and sing and sit in ceremony without having to ask anyone's permission.
When I drove up, I was like, so beautiful to be on our land. We could say this is our home now, right? We're home.
Dean Hoagland is another member of the tribal council. Dean says an elder told him the ancestors were calling him to the land.
Open to us, Ai. Hukuiku aniko. And so what I say in our language is hello to my relatives, to my ancestors.
He's spent 30 years teaching traditional cultural practices as part of a suicide prevention program for Native American youth. He's planning to retire this year. With the extra time, he wants to plant a garden here to grow traditional foods and medicinal plants and teach indigenous land stewardship practices.
It's time that we come back together and that we fulfill what our ancestors always prayed for, and that was for us to come back home and to share the original teachings and share the values of not only indigenous way as far as, you know, how to be a good relative, but how to be a good human being.
Dean and Joe dreamed for years of having land, but it didn't become a real possibility until they created a nonprofit and started raising money. When they found this piece of land in Nicasio for sale, it felt right. So they wrote the couple who owned it a letter. Joe read me a bit of it.
We come to the negotiation table with you carrying the prayers and hopes of our ancestors, the Hukuiko people, known today as the Coast Miwok of Marin.
They explained it would take some time for them to come up with the $1.3 million the sellers were asking.
What we do bring to the table that no other buyer can offer you is the opportunity to be part of the healing process for us, our ancestors, and the land itself.
They reminded the sellers that for some 10,000 years, those ancestors had lived on this land and throughout all of what's now Marin County and much of Sonoma County.
We pray that our story speaks to your hearts. With gratitude, Joe Sanchez.
The letter worked.
the sellers agreed to their timeline. And after 2 months of furious fundraising, they had the money. A lot of it came from foundations, but there were individual donations too. One person gave $25, another $200,000. And on July 3rd, the deal closed. It's believed to be the first modern land back effort in Marin County. But Joe and Dean have a long way to go to make their vision a reality. As they figure out how to fund it, they're planning to apply for grants and are meeting with more potential donors. We trek up the hill to take in the views.
See how it opens up? Magnificent, right?
It took so much effort to get this little piece of Joe's homeland back. I ask him if he has any conflicted feelings about it, about having to ask for charity from others who've built their wealth on this land.
Yeah, we'd like to see the county give us the land, but we took it upon ourselves to get as what we could when the time presented itself.
Joe says he's moved by the support they got.
It's a profound feeling to know that people came to us to help us. It's just extremely powerful.
He stops and looks out over miles of green and gold hills that stretch to the coast.
We're very grateful, but all of this land is Coast Miwok land, unceded Coast Miwok land. We didn't sell the land. We weren't compensated for the land.
That history is never far from Joe's mind. There are reminders everywhere. This county's name, Marin, comes from the name given to a Coast Miwok chief by missionaries. Joe points out an area nearby, one of the last Coast Miwok villages until it was sold off in the late 1800s.
We had 30 acres basically right across the road over there. That was our last little land that we had.
At the end, there were just 36 Coast Miwok living together here. They're part of why Joe was drawn to this piece of land. He wants to hold on to that heritage and pass it on.
This isn't just for us, this is for our generations to come.
He's always seen the past here. Now he sees a future, too. For the California Report, I'm Vanessa Rancagno.
And that's it for the California Report magazine for this week. Our interim senior editor is Katrina Schwartz. Susie Racho is our director producer. Our engineer is Brendan Willard. And Olivia Zhao is our intern. I'm Sasha Koka. Thanks so much for listening. This is the California Report magazine. Your state, your stories.
Hi, KQED listeners. I'm poet and author Xinyi Pai. On the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network, I explore modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about their owner. Our newest season brings you stories of trailblazing Asian American women and surprising objects they hold on to. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
Did you ever wonder what it's like to live alone, hidden in the woods, not speaking to a single soul for 30 years? Or wander the desert, uncover a hidden well, and dive to the bottom of the deepest water hole for 2,000 miles? The Snap Judgment Podcast takes you there with amazing stories told by the people who live them, with an original soundscape that drops you directly into their shoes. Snap Judgment. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.